On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. North Korea's apparent threat to test launch a long-range missile is escalating international tensions from Pyongyang to Washington. The test launch could move the isolated Stalinist regime one step closer to being able to hit the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. Washington says the launch would be a provocation, while hinting that the missile could be shot down. A former U.S. defense secretary writes today that the U.S. should be prepared to strike and destroy the missile before it's launched. Behind the crisis is North Korea's desire for direct talks with Washington and assurances that it won't be attacked. But the Bush administration calls the Pyongyang regime part of the axis of evil and refuses bilateral negotiations. Up next on Point, North Korea's missile threat, a gathering nuclear crisis or bluff. We'll hear in this hour from Seoul, South Korea, and also from a former Assistant Secretary of Defense who is making a provocative call for a preemptive military strike on North Korea's test missile. But we begin in Washington now with Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, who's been watching closely the Bush administration's approach to this blooming missile crisis. And Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Can you bring us up to date how the Bush administration has responded to the possibility that North Korea could test launch an intercontinental ballistic missile? What's going on in the diplomatic scene in Washington?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is, statements and words to the effect that they shouldn't do this. I mean, it's worth noting that we don't know very much about this missile, and the idea that it could actually reach the continental United States, I think, is rather far-fetched.
It's a little speculative. What do we know about this?
It's also very speculative to say that they've actually fueled this missile.
Mm-hmm.
There have been very inaccurate news reports during the week suggesting that it's been completely fueled. What U.S. spy satellites have seen is that there are fuel canisters around the site. The South Koreans actually argue that there's not enough there to actually fill up the missile. I mean, obviously, there is a missile stacked there, and, they haven't gone this far before, but the North Koreans have a long history of doing things for the benefits of U.S. spy satellites to kind of gin up anxious sentiments around the world.
Hmm. Well, what would be their purpose? I mean, is this being regarded by some as a way to restart these talks, to put pressure on the U.S. for these bilateral negotiations that the U.S. doesn't want to participate in?
Yes. I mean, that's been the suggestion, though. It's worth noting that while they've publicly said the United States should come to the table and discuss this with them if they are interested in resolving this problem, that message has not been delivered through private channels, which is ordinarily how this works. So U.S. officials don't really take those press statements that seriously. It could be that the North Koreans are watching the Iranians and seeing how well they're doing with the United States by putting pressure on the U.S. with their nuclear program. They figured this was a way to get attention again. I don't think that the North Koreans are all that serious about negotiating a solution with their nuclear program with this current administration.
Interesting.
It'd be a real stretch to see that happening based on their experience of the first 6 years.
Why, though, has the U.S. resisted so strenuously direct talks? They have, the U.S. has insisted on this six-state talks with the two Koreas, Japan, China, Russia, and the U.S. Why does the administration not want to sit down directly with the North Koreans?
Well, I mean, the impulse behind the six-nation talks is that if North Korea makes an agreement that includes its biggest benefactor, China, its closest neighbors, South Korea, Japan, and also Russia and the United States, it's harder to break such an agreement. The previous agreement that the Clinton administration worked out was done bilaterally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the theory behind it. The problem is, in terms of negotiations, it's hard to reach an agreement when you have six different voices at the table. And one of the criticisms of the Bush approach is that in the context of the six-party talks, the Chinese have bilateral discussions all the time with the North Koreans, and that the Japanese do. So it wouldn't necessarily be that much of a stretch for the U.S. to have those talks and still continue on the six-party process.
Mm.
But I should note that the Bush administration was prepared or was thinking of sending its chief negotiator to Pyongyang immediately after the agreement that was sent signed last September. I mean, and that would have really broken that taboo, but the price of admission, so to speak, was for the North Koreans to turn off their nuclear reactor. Then Hill would have gone to Pyongyang.
Which they were unprepared to do.
They refused to do it, so Hill did not go. So the administration, you know, their argument is if they were going to get something like real bilateral discussions, they've got to earn it. And the best way to earn it is actually turn off the reactor, which right now is producing enough plutonium to for one nuclear bomb a year.
Mm-hmm. So as we stand now, though, the state of the six-party talks essentially dead. They're not ongoing as we speak, correct?
That's right. They've not convened since November of last year. The North Koreans have refused to come back. In September of last year, the six parties reached a statement of principle for negotiations, and which would have guided the way to end their programs, and it was considered quite an achievement. To some extent, the North Koreans have pocketed that agreement because it allowed the Chinese and the South Koreans to step up economic aid and investment because North Korea was able to point to it and say, look, we went as far as we could. We're committed. It's the nasty Americans that are causing problems here.
Okay, Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. I want to turn now to Robert Hewson. He's joining us from London. He's an editor for Jane's Defense Weekly to get some slightly deeper understanding of this potential missile crisis. And Robert Hewson, what's your understanding of what's being reported? Does it appear to you that North Korea is poised to test launch this so-called Taepodong missile?
And I have to say that no, it doesn't. I'm quite alarmed by the degree of hysteria that has crept into much of the reporting that we're seeing about this event, when there seems to be absolutely no evidence whatever that even a test launch is planned. And there's certainly no reliable evidence to allow us to evaluate this missile. Everything that you're seeing, everything that you're hearing and reading is completely speculative, and there's almost zero hard information behind all of the rather alarmist stories that are out there right now.
Well, the source of these alarmist stories, I mean, where are they coming from? What's your understanding? Who's putting them out?
They're coming from the White House, and everything is being done with a large degree of smoke and mirrors. The quote you played from the president there earlier illustrates it very nicely. He used lots of button phrases, missiles, a non-transparent state, nuclear weapons, and joined them all up in a sentence. But there's absolutely no evidence to say that North Korea has this capability. The idea that there's a missile out there that can hit the United States is nonsense. The last time Korea fired a missile was in 1998, and most people are agreed now that that was a failed attempt at putting a satellite into space.
Now, Robert, that missile, just to be clear, that missile was fired over Japan, correct? And it went down in the Pacific
Ocean.
That
was where its trajectory took it.
Yeah.
But there's everything that we are saying, or everything that we are anticipating for the improved version 2 rocket is based entirely on what we think we know about the version 1 rocket, which is really not very much at all. And one thing that I would like to see is a picture of this thing on the launch site.
So we haven't even seen that. A spy satellite hasn't even seen that.
Well, nothing has been released publicly, and there are now several publicly accessible sources of satellite imagery, all of which are looking at this launch site right now, all of which are perfectly capable of showing us whether or not this Taepodong 2 missile is sitting on the site. And the most recent imagery that I have seen, which is a few days old, admittedly, shows an empty launch pad. And everything that we are doing now is predicated on reports of suspicious activity and possible preparations and X number of fuel tanks moving in and out of sheds. It's completely speculative. And I wish we had a little bit more hard information here before we all started losing our heads.
Assuming, and I'm very grateful for the perspective you're providing here, but let's assume for a moment that a missile does exist, and just for the sake of this discussion, not to gin up the tension, but just for the sake of this discussion, that it could be test-fired. How far away is North Korea from being able to load it with a nuclear warhead?
Well, all respectable assessments say that possibility is perhaps a decade or more away. Yes, North Korea has said that it possesses nuclear weapons, and the jury is out on exactly what constitutes a weapon. But even if they do have a weapon and they have the production facility to make nuclear devices, the ability to miniaturize that and get it into a North Korean-built missile, which is a small, unsophisticated device with very little testing and very little real technical expertise behind it, to combine those two things and get it into an effective weapon that could attack over the kind of distances that we're hearing, you know, weapons that can hit Seattle, this is just rubbish. That kind of threat is not there and is far, far away. There's nothing, there's no evidence to say that that kind of thing is something that we have to face in the short or near-term future.
Well, there's a calming and sober voice from London, Robert Hewson, editor of Jane's Defense Weekly. Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier this week, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said it would be a provocative act if North Korea were to launch a test missile.
It would once again show North Korea determined to deepen its isolation, determined not to take a path that is a path of compromise and a path of peace.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice speaking earlier this week. And joining me now from New York is Ashton Carter. He is co-director of the Preventive Defense Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government from 1993 to 96. Carter served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Clinton and focused heavily on North Korea. And in 1999, after a comprehensive North Korea policy review, he made the first visit in 50 years by a U.S. presidential envoy to Pyongyang. So he's been right in the North Korea hot seat himself. And Ashton Carter, thanks so much for being here today.
Good to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you. You've been a long advocate of negotiation with North Korea. As we mentioned, you actually went to Pyongyang. But in today's Washington Post, you write a piece with your former boss, former Defense Secretary William Perry, that the U.S. should threaten to take out the North Korean missile with an airstrike and be prepared to follow through. Well, why is that the right approach now?
Well, that's right. And let me put it in context.
Sure.
Your previous speaker suggested that the Taepodong missile, which is the missile in question, a test missile out of North Korea, is not yet at the point of launch. And I think that's probably right. By the way, just so your listeners understand, no one believes that this missile, if it were launched, would attack the United States or is designed to land in Seattle or anywhere else. This is a test missile. However, they're testing it in order to perfect the capability to do precisely that. We don't have to guess whether that's what they're doing or not. That's what they say they're doing. And, of course, North Korea also separately is making nuclear weapons. In the last 3 or 4 years, they've obtained somewhere between 6 and 8 weapons worth of plutonium. No one doubts that they can fashion nuclear warheads out of that plutonium.
But as
they
have. Do you disagree, though, with Robert Hewson, who said we're a good 10 years away from that? So I guess my
I don't know anybody who'd support that number. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the North Koreans don't. Mm-hmm. They have the plutonium to make the bombs. They say they have. They have a shorter-range missile called the Nodong, which we know very well because they've sold it to places like Pakistan and Iran. And we know it's explicitly designed to carry a nuclear warhead. It's large enough to carry the kind of warhead that they could build, which is a not as small as our warheads, but small enough to be carried aboard a missile. But at any rate, this
is
not.
So there's a threat.
There's a threat. Yeah. And the threat is that they conduct this test. And what happens if they conduct this test successfully? First of all, they get the data that allows them to perfect a missile force that could threaten the United States in the future. And second, it would be just another step in the emboldening of North Korea. What's happened over the last few years is that the negotiations have not been pursued seriously by almost any party to them. And in the absence of any counter pressure, the North Koreans have just gotten away with murder. They're making more plutonium, which they never made during the 1990s. They're saying that they're going to become a nuclear power and that they're building a missile force to deliver nuclear warheads to this country. And my former boss, Bill Perry, and I just don't think we can sit back and allow that kind of momentum to continue to gather. Now, the North Koreans still have a chance to do the right thing, which is not launch that missile. Hmm. Maybe they're faking, maybe they're bluffing, but they're doing something out there at that test site with those missile stages and that missile fuel.
Right.
And sometime over the next few weeks, they could erect that missile and fuel that missile. And what we're saying is that if they do so, they should be on notice that that's a very vulnerable target, and we're prepared to take it out with, for example, a cruise missile, not a nuclear strike, but high explosive strike that would be small and surgical, like the strike we mounted against Zarqawi in Iraq a few weeks ago. That
sure.
kind of thing.
But Ashton Carter, let me push back a little bit there. Isn't attacking an isolated, some might say, paranoid regime like North Korea extremely risky? You've written in the past that an attack on North Korea could unleash a war on the Korean Peninsula that would inevitably involve U.S. troops in Korea, Japan. Wouldn't this be a big risk, and is it really worth taking?
It is risky, but I don't think it risks an all-out war on the Korean Peninsula for a few reasons. The first is that, as I just mentioned, this is not an attack on North Korea, the North Korean nation. It's not an attack on the North Korean military.
But
it's
wouldn't they see
like
it that way?
Scale.
I mean, wouldn't they see it that way?
I think what you have to do is announce to North Korea in advance your intention to take this act, your intention to confine it to the source of the problem, which is a missile that they are perfecting in order to threaten us. That's the issue we have with them. We're not trying to start a larger war with them. And this is not anything that could be interpreted as an attack on their country as a whole. Moreover, what we have worried about in the past and did in 1994 when we were planning a much larger strike on their entire nuclear complex was, of course, that North Korea's large, antiquated but large and fanatical army would pour over the DMZ into South Korea. At that time, South Korea and the United States were much more closely aligned in their view of North Korea than we are, sadly, today. So the South Koreans will have nothing to do with this. Militarily, they will oppose President Bush's announcement of his intention to do this if he accepts our recommendation. And it makes no sense for the South Koreans to attack – I mean the North Koreans to attack South Korea after the United States has taken a limited measure to eliminate a threat to itself. So I don't think that the North Koreans will respond. I think at the same time that we indicate to them that we just can't let this thing be launched, we should warn them against that kind of reckless escalation. But this is solely about – a missile being tested and designed to threaten us. And there's still plenty of room for them to back out, return to the negotiations and so forth. And I very much hope they do, because I don't want to bear this risk either. But the risk on the other side of letting them go ahead and perfect a missile design for us is, I judge, greater.
So you still hold out some hope. I mean, if you hold out some hope for diplomacy and negotiations, you in the past, as a member of the Clinton administration, would have preferred bilateral negotiations. The Bush administration is strenuously against that. Is that a problem? Does that hamper potential progress with this thorny, vexing diplomatic issue?
I do favor negotiating with the North Koreans, and believe me, I know how maddening that is. But the contrary view, which some in the Bush administration have had, that the North Koreans are bad guys and therefore we shouldn't talk to them, I don't accept. Of course, they are very unpleasant in many ways, but they're there. And they're threatening, and you have to deal with them. So to refuse to talk to them, which is essentially what we've done for the last 6 years, is, I think, a mistake. Now, you raised the question of whether we ought to talk to them one-on-one,
yeah,
or whether the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Russians, and the Chinese ought to be at the table, which is the theory of the six-party talks. I think the theory of the six-party talks is fine. The problem, from our point of view, in the six-party talks has not been that others have been in the room. It's that the Americans haven't said anything. Why is that? The reason for that is that our government has been divided in its own councils between two camps. a camp that I guess would share my view and the kind of view that we were trying to formulate in the Clinton administration. Let's try to talk to these guys, wacky as they are, and see if we can get them in a box that is safe. The other view is the one I mentioned earlier, which President Bush expressed when he said he loathed Kim Jong-il, which is that you don't dignify people like Kim Jong-il with talks. Well, those two factions have been at loggerheads, and what that has meant is that American negotiations at the table have not had a coherent position. And if you add to that the fact that the South Koreans have their head in the sand on this whole issue, the Chinese are not doing what they should to pressure North Korea, and the North Koreans, of course, are their inimitable selves, you have the picture we've had of the six-party talks, which is everybody sitting there and nothing happening.
Well, there you have it. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation with Ashton Carter about North Korea. You've heard Ashton Carter say we've got to be prepared to strike the missile if necessary, but negotiations would be preferable. Let's take a call. Johnny is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, good morning. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's on your mind?
I was listening to your speaker, and I maybe I misunderstood, but I thought I heard him say to announce that we're going to attack this missile would then be tantamount to not for them to say, no, it's not an attack because you told us we're going to attack, and therefore it wouldn't create a war on the peninsula. Is that what I heard?
That's pretty much what Ashton Carter said, but you can ask him directly yourself. It sounds like you have concerns with the idea of a preemptive strike.
Absolutely. The missile that we're going to strike, first of all, as your caller from James Weekly said, is not being fueled. It's not on the pad. Is there a picture to show me this missile that we're going to attack?
Well, let me put that to Ashton Carter. Ashton Carter, what do you feel we really understand about this missile and its potential readiness for a test fire?
Well, I think Johnny makes a good point. The time is not now to take any drastic action like this certainly would be. And in that, I agree with him. We apparently have some time. I think the specific answer to your question is that the missile stages, this is a missile that is made up of a bunch of smaller missiles all strapped together. Those pieces have all been brought out to the test range. The North Koreans themselves have indicated that they intend to make such a test. There are apparently fuel tanks being brought there also. So these are the normal preparations that would precede a test. And what we're suggesting is that we say to the North Koreans that if they proceed in the coming weeks to erect the missile, strap all the pieces together, put the fuel in, and then start to count down to a launch, that's, from our point of view, allowing them to perfect an offensive capability against our country, and that we feel we need to act. We're going to act in a very limited way to protect ourselves against a threat to us. We're not widening the campaign in any way, attacking other targets, and that it makes sense for them to show restraint not to overreact to it. And as I said, I think that with that explanation and that warning, they'll have time to think about it and will conclude it does not make sense for them to overreact.
Ashton Carter, stand by. I want to bring in another voice, this one from Seoul, South Korea. Donald Gregg was ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993. He's chairman of the Korea Society, national security advisor to then Vice President George Bush, 1982 to 1988. And Donald Gregg, Ambassador Gregg, thanks for being with us today.
A pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know you've been listening. What's your take on the crisis? And you can jump into this conversation any way you want. Maybe the most provocative ideas come from Ashton Carter this morning. Is it a good idea to sort of hold that card of a potential preemptive strike in our hands?
Yeah, I guess you could hold it in. I would hold it in reserve. I read his op-ed and with great sadness and deep concern, because Ash and Bill Perry are the heroes of the time in 1999 and 2000 that were the high watermark of our relations with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It was the very, very careful work they did in defusing the first Taepodong crisis that led to the visit of Jo Myung-rok to Washington, the invitation to President Clinton to go to Pyongyang, the actual visit of Madeleine Albright.
And that led to the so-called agreed framework, correct, under which North Korea froze?
No. There was another agreement signed by Madeleine Albright and Jo Myung-rok at that time, which was so short-lived that it hadn't had much publicity. But what concerns me is that the ineffectiveness of the Bush policy has driven these two excellent men to make a tremendously high-risk option. And I have four or five points that I would like to make at some point. I don't know how you want to work this.
Oh, no, I appreciate that. We'll definitely get to them. But let's let Ashton Carter just respond to the sort of general concern you raise. And Ashton Carter, I wanted to get to the work that you did back there in the 90s that Ambassador Gregg is talking about. But first, you know, his suggestion that it's the Bush administration's policy that have driven you to you and former Defense Secretary Perry to a less cautious approach, perhaps, if I understand what Ambassador Gregg is saying.
Well, it is with great sadness and great concern that we've come to this point. This is a step that no one wants to take, and we still don't want to have to take. But the North Koreans have basically run amok for the last 5 years, and that's trouble down the road. And at some point, it has to stop. Now, this is a situation, as I mentioned earlier, where there's so much blame to go all around that you don't know where to start. Obviously, it's the North Koreans where blame must, in the first instance, be affixed. But I agree with Ambassador Gregg, and no one knows the Korean scene better than he, that this administration has essentially had no policy for dealing with North Korea because, as I said earlier, they're of two minds and they've never resolved the disagreement between the two camps within their ranks. Well, in that kind of environment, the North Koreans, it's like seeing a hole in a defensive line for a running back. They just run in between those two factions and they're well downfield now to getting a nuclear arsenal and a missile arsenal, and at some point they need to stop. This seems like a good time and a good place to put down a marker and say, listen, no further.
Ambassador Gregg, I wanted to come back to you. What is the best move for the Bush administration at this point, whether or not this missile is poised to be test-fired? And there seems to be some consensus that the reports might be somewhat exaggerated. But what should the Bush administration be doing to defuse this problem on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, it's the Koreans, the North Koreans have overplayed their hand. They should know better than to threaten us with a missile launch and try to get us to talk under pressure. So they have misplayed their hand, and I think a cooling off period is needed for all. But I do want to get at some of my specific concerns about what Ash and Bill Perry have suggested.
Please.
The first point I would make is that the number one objective of Kim Jong-il's regime is survival, not suicide. They are building nuclear capacity of some sort, but its raison d'etre is deterrence, not attack. They are smart enough to know that if they were to attempt to fly anything at the United States, with a nuclear warhead, successful or not, their country would run the risk of obliteration. And so I think that there's an exaggeration of what this missile might pose to us because their motivation has always been deterrence, not attack. Second, on timing, I think if we give the North Koreans warning that we may attack it, they are capable of moving ahead and firing the missile before we're ready to take it out, which would leave us looking like sort of reckless provocateurs. I also think if we launched a missile at North Korea, they would respond in some way. They might say, all right, we'll have a one-on-one response. We'll fire a Scud into an American Army base north of Seoul. Their Scuds are not that accurate. A lot of Koreans would be killed. and war hysteria would be unleashed on the Korean Peninsula.
Okay, Ambassador, let's let Ashton Carter come back and respond to some of that. You've heard some of the concerns laid out by Ambassador Gregg. Ashton Carter, what's your response?
Well, his first point is absolutely right, that the North Korean objective is not suicide, and that's why I don't believe they would launch a war or any major response to an act of the kind that we're suggesting we might have to be forced to, a limited attack on a missile shortly before it's launched. I don't agree with Ambassador Gregg with respect as simply as a technical military matter about the time scale. It's going to be some time before they can prepare this large missile for launch that we discussed earlier in the program, some weeks. And it doesn't take long to program a Tomahawk cruise missile, for example. And in fact, I would be astonished as a former Pentagon planner myself if those coordinates were not already programmed into a U.S. Cruise missile. Let us say. And so I don't think there's any question that we could credibly make the threat. The president could if he chose to do so today.
I want to get a couple of callers into this conversation. We've got a lot standing by. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation about North Korea. Lisa is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Ev.
What's on your mind?
I've got two things. After listening to the gentleman's Ashton's last comment, I wanted to say I really have two points. The reason that I, on his last comment, he was talking about the risk. And what I keep hearing back and forth is essentially they've got to do the right thing. They've got to do the right thing. Others should force them to do the right thing.
And they have to do the right thing being North Korea.
That's correct.
Right.
But I must ask why they are expected to take all the risk politically, meaning we're saying that, you know, If which your Danes specialist said that they don't have the capability and probably won't have the capability for 10 years, if they don't have the capability, then it's probably a balance of power question. And why are they expected to take all of the risk and not have any of the cultural benefit? Meaning, if it's a power play, if they're looking for a power play, and I don't know that they are, but it would seem reasonable that they would want to increase their stature in their regional politics, and that this might be a means to do so, then this sounds like a lot of smoke and mirrors. And why are we not willing to take any risks?
Okay, Lisa, I get your point. The point you put on the table is a good one, and I think both Ashton Carter and Ambassador Gregg would be good people to respond to this. I mean, if I hear what Lisa's saying, Ashton Carter, this is an issue that you've written about and been very involved with. North Korea is looking for something pretty concrete here, and that is they want to deal with the U.S. and some sort of security guarantee that they're not going to be attacked. And why not come to them and give them that? I mean, I know you're not in the current administration, but I mean, is where Lisa's coming from a valid perspective here on this?
I think absolutely it is. I am perfectly prepared, and would have the United States be perfectly prepared to say to the North Koreans, we're not out to get you. We're not trying to bring down your regime. We're not going to invade you. I would oppose any such action. So we're happy to let you be what you are. We don't like the kind of government you are, the kind of regime you are, and we're not going to change our values with respect to you. But we're not out to get you. However, and you can keep on keeping on there unmolested. But what we can't allow is for you to develop a threat that you say is designed for us. And we're taking the risk if we allow them to proceed down this path to make a threat to us. It's no risk to them if they simply say, okay, we're not going to launch this missile. We're not asking them to surrender. We're not threatening to invade them. All they have to do is not go down this path.
I want to bring in one more voice into this conversation. Peter Beck is Northeast Asia Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He lives in Seoul, South Korea, and he joins us now from South Korea. And Peter Beck, welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to this discussion all the while here. Give us the sort of view from the ground in South Korea. What are you hearing there, and what do you take away from this debate and this discussion so far?
Well, I was just in North Korea today visiting the Gaesong Industrial Complex, and I happened to be sitting in a 24-story apartment building in Seoul, and so I guess I'm as directly affected as any Korean could be if things turn ugly here. Quite frankly, the average Korean is much more worried about South Korea making the round of 16 in the World Cup than they are about a potential missile launch.
Uh-huh. That might be a healthier concern.
At least for this week. But I have to say I'm profoundly disappointed that such a respected member of the scholarly and a scholar statesman like Ashton Carter Ash is being far too rash when it comes to proposing a preemptive strike that would be dangerous, reckless. The military consequences, the strategic and diplomatic consequences would be potentially catastrophic for this peninsula and for certainly America's already tenuous relationship with the rest of the world.
But I mean, I'm going to let Ashton Carter, defend his own position. But let me ask you this, Peter Beck, and I'd love Ambassador Gregg to chime in too. Isn't the risk that such a strike would be reducing? It's not only the potential for an attack on the U.S., but it's the whole issue of proliferation. I mean, if North Korea is allowed to go ahead and develop a nuclear weapons program that gets past a certain point, it's not the most stable part of the world to have those kinds of weapons in those kinds of hands.
That's why we needed more active diplomatic efforts. We've had 3 months of serious negotiations out of the last 66 months that the Bush administration has been in office. And we have an assistant secretary of state who has been given 2 full-time jobs of managing Asia and also managing negotiations with North Korea. That's an impossible task, to do both of those jobs well. So the Bush administration has never been serious about negotiating with North Korea, and so to contemplate a strike before exhausting all diplomatic means is very dangerous and disturbing.
Hmm. Ashton Carter, do you want to respond? You're taking hits from Ambassador Gregg, from Peter Beck, from a couple of callers. I want to give you a chance.
Well, I think that with great respect to Peter, we're at a point where there's risk, and I completely agree with him. I lament that we are at this point, but we are, where there is risk in either path. There's clearly risk in threatening this action. I hope that by threatening this action and making our resolve clear, North Korea decides that on the whole, it's not worth testing this missile. They're pushing us too far. But the risk on the other side is to let North Korea continue to be emboldened in the way that it has over the last few years with respect to ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons that it itself says are designed for us. So there's risk in either path, but those who want us to do nothing about this, I think, have to bear the burden of explaining the risk of their option as well. Again, I hope it doesn't become necessary to do anything like this, but I think to sit back and let them perfect a missile designed to attack us is exactly the kind of thing that we can't allow to happen in the world in which we live.
Pratik is calling from Washington, D.C. Pratik, thanks for calling.
Hi, I want to take issue with particularly the ambassador, but also Ashton Carter. If you look at the North Koreans' behavior since the 90s and arguably before that, they haven't shown a willingness to engage diplomatically and a broader willingness to actually settle these issues diplomatically. I think there's a fundamental failure here in recognizing the nature of the North Korean regime. So I'd like to actually challenge Ashton Carter. Why aren't we looking at a much broader preemptive strike, which would severely damage North Korea's nuclear capacity beyond their missiles, to make sure that they don't, A, attack us directly, but B, sell or hand over technology to either directly to terrorists or a terrorist state like Iran or Libya.
Okay, Pratik, I'll put that to Ashton, but let me take the first part of your point, because I want to get Ambassador Donald Gregg back in this conversation. This idea that Pratik raises, Ambassador Gregg, that we can't do business with the North Koreans, that there is no diplomatic solution to this. Is that true? Is that your view?
I reject that completely. And I think that the suggestion by this caller is much more out of bounds than what Ash is reluctantly putting forward. And the damage that even making this suggestion would do to the alliance we have with Seoul, which is already under a great strain, would be profound. And if we consulted and then went ahead, or did not consult and went ahead, the Koreans would feel that we have absolutely no concern for their interests. As Peter said, they don't feel threatened by these missiles. And there is a disconnect between our thinking and the South Koreans. They are not sufficiently concerned about North Korea as a proliferator. Their major concern is reconciliation on the peninsula, and some South Koreans think that is a panacea for all the problems we're dealing with as an alliance, and we don't share that view.
Hmm. And Ashton Carter, do you want to respond to this idea that your call to a preemptive strike doesn't go far enough, and maybe we should put together, resurrect that plan that was there in the late 90s to take out their whole nuclear program?
Well, first, I want to agree with Don Gregg. Diplomacy has worked with North Korea. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work perfectly. It's maddening. But, for example, from 1994 until 2002, they did not make any plutonium at Yongbyon by agreement with us, an agreement which, in that respect, they abided by. It turns out that in another respect, which wasn't as dangerous but still annoying, they were cheating in that agreement. So the North Koreans, you can make some mileage with them diplomatically. You can't get everywhere you would like to get with a regime like North Korea, but diplomacy does work and should not be given up on. And no, I would not recommend at this time a wider kind of strike. It's not time to think about that kind of thing yet. And for now, I think that we need to focus on this provocative act that they're about to take and making it clear to them that we really are drawing the line here. This is going too far. And if that brings everybody back to the negotiating table with a fresh and clear sense of what's at risk here and what can be achieved by diplomacy, no one would be more delighted than I.
But is that really a way to bring them back to the is that the way to bring an isolated and paranoid regime back to the negotiating table, I guess, with that kind of threat? Because it seems to me that what the North Koreans are worried about is precisely what you're saying we might have to do. And so isn't that just going to cause them to sort of batten down the hatches further and not come to the table and negotiate seriously?
Well, we need to show the North Koreans the way out here. And the way out for them is for them to cut it out with the ballistic missiles and the nuclear weapons, and for us to cut it out with acting like we don't want them to exist at all as a regime. If we could wish away the North Korean regime, of course we would do that. But if we suggest to them, as we have, unfortunately, this administration has suggested sometime, that we're not only after their weapons of mass destruction, were after them, well, then they're never going to give up their weapons of mass destruction. So you have to say to them, look, it's about the WMD, knock it off, and we will knock off the idea of threatening you, of changing your regime, of invading you. That's the germ of the deal that I think everybody knows is really the way to go for both sides.
Peter Beck, we're just about out of time. We've got a few seconds left, but last word to you. What's the sort of parting thought that you want to leave with us?
Well, you know, we had a hopeful start last summer, and that's what I was referring to in the 3 months of really serious negotiations. And that's what we really need to get back to. The North Koreans are looking for attention. They're not trying to strike the United States. They're trying to get our attention, and they want some respect now. They're not the easiest regime to show respect towards, but that's what they're looking for. And I do think they're willing to negotiate, and we can reach some understanding if there's a willingness on both sides.
Well, let's hope that that can happen. I want to thank all my guests. We're out of time. Ashton Carter, co-director of the Preventive Defense Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
And Donald Gregg, former ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993. Thank you, Ambassador Gregg.
My pleasure.
And Peter Beck, Northeast Asia Project Director for the International Crisis Group.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.